Chapter 19. Austin sat in his study hunting the sea marauders who had hijacked the container ship. The magic carpet that carried him over the virtual sea was a satellite imaging system operated by NUMA. Dubbed NUMASAT, the sophisticated system had been developed by the agency's scientists and technicians to provide instantaneous pictures of the world's oceans. Satellites circled 400 miles above the Earth in orbits that allowed their cameras and other remote sensing equipment to transmit information from any point on the globe. The satellites transmitted optical or infrared pictures of water surface temperature, currents, phytoplankton, chlorophyll, cloud cover, meteorological, and other vital information. The system was available free of charge to anyone with a computer and was heavily used by scientists and non-scientists around the world. Austin was sitting in front of a 24-inch wide computer monitor. He was casually dressed in a Hawaiian shirt, shorts, and sandals. He washed down a couple of aspirin with a beer and punched enter on his keyboard. A satellite image of the rugged Newfoundland coast materialized on the screen. "Okay, Joe," he said into his speakerphone. "I'm looking at St. John's and points east."
"Gotcha."
Zavala had the same image on a computer screen in his NUMA office.
"I'll zoom in."
A shimmering bluish-white rectangle popped up on Austin's screen, superimposing itself on a section of Atlantic Ocean. Zavala expanded the size of the square. Tiny black specks appeared. The specks grew in size and began to assume the long, slim shape of ships. The time and date in the upper left-hand corner of the screen indicated that the picture had been taken several days before. "How close can you go?" Austin said.
"Pick a target."
Austin clicked his computer cursor on a blip. The camera seemed to rush at the target. Hundreds of flopping fish filled the screen. Then the camera pulled back to show a fish hold and a deck covered with the booms and winches of an ocean-going fishing boat.
"Impressive," Austin said. "Jaeger used Max to pump some hormones into NUMASAT's normal search function. He says it can tell you the color of a sand flea's eyes."
Hiram Jaeger was NUMA's resident computer genius and director of the vast computer complex he called Max, which occupied the entire 10th floor of NUMA's green glass-faced tower overlooking the Potomac River.
"Their eyes are blue," Austin said.
"Really?"
"Kidding. But the resolution is better than anything I've seen."
"Before Jaeger beefed up the system, the best we could get was 1 yard square in black and white and 4 yards in color."
"He's got it down to 1 yard square in color," Zavala said. "What you're seeing on the screen has been enhanced by information coming in from other satellites and military and intelligence systems."
"All done legally and according to Hoyle," Austin said with a wry smile.
"Mostly. Jaeger considers it tit for tat, because the military relies so heavily on NUMASAT. They've worked out a deal to blank out images when military operations are underway. I told him I didn't want to know, and he said that was fine with him."
"We're in no position to criticize," Austin said. "The special assignments team sometimes operated under the radar of traditional government oversight." "Have you located our friendly ore carrier?" Austin said.
"Watch," Zavala said.
The image slowly zoomed out. The ships again were displayed as specks. Zavala outlined a target within a rectangle. Austin clicked the computer mouse. The image of a huge ship filled the screen. Austin leaned forward.
"Definitely the ore carrier we saw from the chopper," he said. "There's that weird bull's head logo on the hull.
I ran a check on the ship. It belongs to an outfit named Peace Co. Their website describes them as peace and stability consultants."
Austin chuckled. "That's the new jargon for mercenaries.
They're upfront about the ship's conversion from an ore carrier. They advertise it as a mobile force platform. They claim they can have airborne forces on the ground anywhere in the world within 48 hours. The ship is guaranteed to arrive with the full unit within 21 days.
Who's behind Peace Co?
Hard to tell. They've got a roster of retired American and British military people on their board. The ownership is hidden behind layers of shell corporations in several countries of registration. I've got Jaeger working to unravel that mess, too.
Sounds like a lead. But what we need is a smoking gun.
Hell, Kurt, we've got a fully loaded howitzer. I've run a sequential album from the archives, starting shortly before the hijacking. These shots were taken at intervals, so they don't cover every minute.
Images flickered on the screen in a jerky stop-action mode, like pictures in a Nickelodeon. Figures were moving around a cargo hatch. The cover slid back until the hold was revealed as a dark square. A platform rose from the ship's innards of the hold like the elevator on an aircraft carrier. Two helicopters could be seen parked side by side on the platform. Men got into the helicopters, and the choppers took off.
"Who says time travel is impossible?" Austin said.
"That nails down our launch.
Next, I'll show you the container ship."
The image changed to show the deck of the Ocean Adventure. The choppers appeared as if by magic atop the containers. Figures streamed out of the aircraft. There was little change for several frames until the satellite showed one helicopter hovering above a foaming circle in the ocean where its companion had gone down. Zavala jumped back to the ore carrier. A single helicopter returned to land on the platform. Figures got out of the helicopter. It was lowered back into the ship, and the cargo hold cover was slid back over the opening. One of the figures, who was taller than the others, could have been the man who shot Austin, but his back was to the camera.
"That nails it," Austin said. "Where's the ship now?"
"The maritime schedules I checked have her leaving New York a few days before the hijacking, supposedly on her way to Spain. She did a funny little loop around the time of the hijacking, then kept on heading across the Atlantic. I can turn this stuff over to the Coast Guard with a flick of a switch."
"Tempting," Austin said. "She's in international waters, and even if the Coast Guard jumped in now, at best we'd snag only the little guys. I want the brains behind the hijacking scheme."
"I'll keep sniffing around."
"How are you feeling, by the way?"
"A little stiff, but the incident taught me a good lesson."
"That you should avoid men with guns?"
"Nah.
That I should move faster." "Keep me posted if you turn up anything before you leave for Istanbul."
Austin heard a knocking.
"Gotta go. Someone's at the door."
"Having company?"
"The very best kind."
"Ciao."
The Italian connection dawned on Zavala.
"Ciao."
"Hey."
"Buonanotte, Joe," Austin said. He was chuckling as he hung up and went to open the front door.
Karina McCarty was waiting on the steps. She lifted the wine bottle in her hand.
"I believe I have a dinner reservation for tonight."
"Your table is ready and waiting, Signora McCarty."
"You said casual.
I hope I'm dressed for the occasion." Karina was wearing jeans with flowers stitched on them and a sleeveless blouse of turquoise. Her outfit emphasized her feminine curves in the most flattering way possible. A queen could not be more fashionably attired, Austin said.
"Thank you," Karina purred.
She appraised Austin with equally appreciative eyes. He was wearing white shorts that emphasized his tanned, muscular legs and his wide shoulders strained against a flowered silk shirt.
"And you look quite smashing in that shirt."
"Thanks. Elvis Presley wore the same design in the movie Blue Hawaii."
"Come right in."
Karina stepped into the house, and her eyes took in the comfortable colonial-style dark wood furniture that was set off by white walls hung with original paintings by the local artists Austin liked to collect. There were some antique ocean charts and shipbuilding tools, a photo of Austin's sailboat, and a scale model of his racing hydroplane.
I thought I would see old anchors and stuffed swordfish hanging on the walls. Maybe an old diving helmet or ship models in bottles.
Austin roared with laughter.
I used to drink margaritas in a Key West diver's bar that fits that description.
You know what I mean, Karina said with a smile.
You work for the world's foremost oceanographic agency. I expected more evidence of your love of the sea.
I'll guess that your place in Paris has little in it that would indicate to a stranger what your job is.
I have a few reproductions of classic artworks, but the rest is quite traditional.
She paused.
I get your point. It's healthy to have some space from your work.
I'm not ready to move to Kansas, but the sea is a demanding mistress. That's why the old ship captains usually built their houses inland.
Nevertheless, this is quite lovely.
It wouldn't qualify for a photo spread in Architectural Digest, but it's a great landside retreat for an old sea dog in between assignments. This building was a fixer-upper when I bought it, but it was riverfront property and close to Langley.
Karina picked up on the Langley connection.
You were in the CIA?
Underwater intelligence stuff. Mostly spying on the Russians. We closed shop when the Cold War ended, and I went over to Numa.
Despite Austin's denial, his affinity to the sea was subtly evident in the wall shelves, filled with the sea adventures of Joseph Conrad and Herman Melville. There were dozens of books on ocean science and history. The most hand-worn volumes were on philosophy. She pulled out a well-thumbed book.
Aristotle. Pretty heavy reading, she said.
Studying the great philosophers supplies me with profound quotes that make me seem smarter than I am.
There is more here than bon mots. These books have been much read.
You're very observant.
I'll use a maritime analogy. The wisdom in those pages keeps me anchored when I'm drifting into ambiguous waters. Karina thought about the contrast between Austin's warmth and the way he had coldly dispatched her attacker. She replaced the book on the shelf.
But there is nothing ambiguous about the pistols over the fireplace.
You've exposed my weakness for collecting. I've got around 200 braces of dueling pistols, most stored in a fireproof vault. I'm fascinated by their history as well as the art and technology that went into them. I'm intrigued by what they say about the role of luck in our fates.
Are you a fatalist?
I'm a realist. I know I can't always make my own luck.
He smiled. But I can make your dinner. You must be hungry.
Even if I weren't. The wonderful fragrances coming from your kitchen would make me believe I'm famished.
She handed over the bottle of wine.
Barolo, Austin said. I'll open it and let the wine breathe. We're dining al fresco.
While Austin went to uncork the wine, Karina wandered out onto the deck. The table was lit with oil lamps whose colored glass lent a festive appearance to the setting. Lights sparkled along the Potomac, and there was the slightly rank but not unpleasant smell of the river. Austin put on a recording from his extensive jazz collection, and the soft piano notes of an Oscar Peterson number floated from a couple of Bose speakers. Austin came out with two chilled glasses of Prosecco. They drank the sparkling Italian wine with an antipasti of prosciutto di Parma over honeydew melon. Austin excused himself and came back with plates of fettuccine with cream and butter sauce. Karina almost swooned when he blanketed the dishes with shaved white truffles.
Dear God, where did you find truffles like this in the U.S.?
I didn't.
A Numa colleague has been going back and forth to Italy.
Corina devoured the fettuccine, along with the secondi course, a sautéed veal chop, and a mushroom and cheese salad, again with white truffles. They polished off the bottle of wine. She didn't slow down until she came to dolce, or dessert. As she dug into a dish of Ben and Jerry's Cherry Garcia, she said, "This is magnifico," for about the 10th time during the meal. "You have added Master Chef to your array of accomplishments."
"Grazie," Austin said. He had been amazed at Corina's gusto, but not unpleased. A hearty passion for food often revealed appetites in other areas. They finished off the meal with small frosted glasses of limoncello liquor. As they clanked glasses in toast, Austin said, "You never told me how you came to be babysitting an old statue on its journey to America."
"It's a long story."
"I have time, as well as another bottle of limoncello." She laughed softly and stared out at the river to collect her thoughts.
"I was born in Siena. My father, a doctor, was an amateur archaeologist who was fascinated with the Etruscans."
"Understandable. The Etruscans were a mysterious people."
"Unfortunately, their art was in great demand. As a girl, I saw a site that had been plundered by tombaroli, tomb robbers. There was an arm of pure marble lying in the ground. Later, I went to the University of Milan, then to the London School of Economics, and drifted into journalism. My interest in antiquities was revived by research I did for a magazine article on the role of museums and dealers in art theft. The image of that marble arm stuck with me. I joined UNESCO and became an investigator. Stealing a country's history is one of the worst things someone could do. I wanted to take looting face on."
"That's a pretty tall order."
"As I quickly found out. The trade in illegal antiquities ranks third in international monetary terms, behind drug smuggling and weapons sales. The UN has tried to discourage the trade through treaties and resolutions, but the challenges are formidable. It would be impossible to stop the sale of every cylinder seal or tablet."
"You've evidently had great success."
"I work with a number of international agencies, such as Interpol and governments, trying to track down certain high-profile items, mainly through dealers, auction houses, and museums."
"Is that what brought you to Iraq?"
She nodded. "Weeks before the invasion, we heard rumors that crooked dealers were in touch with the unscrupulous international art dealers and diplomats. They were taking orders for specific artifacts. The thieves were in place, ready to move in as soon as the Republican Guard moved out of the museum."
"Where did the Navigator figure in all this?"
"I didn't even know it existed. It was not on the list of artifacts that I tried to recover through an unsavory dealer named Ali. He was murdered, which is no loss to the world, but he knew where the objects were. I left the country after hearing a warning that I was going to be kidnapped as a hostage. Not long after that, I was contacted by the Baltazar Foundation."
"That's the organization that is sponsoring your tour."
"Mr. Baltazar is a wealthy man who was appalled at the Iraq looting. I met him for the first time at the reception last night. His foundation provided the funds to keep after the artifacts that had eluded me in Baghdad. Not long ago, an Egyptian source said the Iraqi objects were on sale in Cairo. I flew to Egypt and bought the cash. The Navigator was part of the deal."
"What do you know about the statue?"
"It must have been taken from the museum at the same time as the other loot. Professor Nasir, the director of the museum, remembered the statue as being stored in the basement. He considered it a curiosity."
"In what way?"
"It appears to be a Phoenician sailor
but it's carrying a compass. I'm told there is no evidence that the Phoenicians had the compass. That's right. The Chinese get credit for the compass. Professor Nasir figured it might have been a copy of the type of trade goods that the Phoenicians sold. Sort of like the classic statues that are sold as souvenirs in Egypt or Greece. Did your professor friend know where the statue was found? It came from a Hittite site excavation around Black Mountain in southeastern Syria back in the 1970s. It found its way to Baghdad, where its authenticity came into question. I've talked to a National Geographic photographer who was on the site. Strange that it would suddenly be of interest to thieves, and later to hijackers, after sitting in a museum basement all that time. Only a few people ever knew about it, which was why I was so surprised when Mr. Saxon mentioned it to me at the Iraqi embassy reception. Austin's ears perked up at the name. Not Anthony Saxon. Yes. He seemed quite knowledgeable about the statue. Do you know him? I've read his books and attended a lecture he gave. He's an adventurer and writer with an unconventional view of history, one not accepted by mainstream scientists. Could he have had anything to do with the hijacking? I can't picture it. But it would be worth learning why he is so interested in the statue. I'd be interested in meeting the navigator myself. I'm inviting a select few to view the statue. It's at a Smithsonian warehouse in Maryland. Would you like to come tomorrow morning? Wild horses couldn't keep me away. She drained the last of her limoncello. This has been a wonderful evening. I think I hear a but in your voice. She laughed. Sorry. I'd love to stay, but I have much work to do on the tour. I'm completely heartbroken, but I understand. I'll see you tomorrow. A thought seemed to occur to her. I'm going to try to set up a meeting with the National Geographic photographer. He lives in Virginia. Would you like to go along? I'm officially on sick leave, but a ride in the country would do wonders for the healing process. She rose from the chair. Thank you so much, Kurt. For everything. My pleasure, Karina. He walked outside to her car. Austin expected to receive the customary European bus on both cheeks, which was what happened. But she also gave him a warm and lingering kiss on the lips. She tossed a smile over her shoulder, got in the car, and drove off. Austin had a funny smile on his face as he watched the car taillights disappear down the driveway. Then he went back into the house and went out on the deck to clear away the glasses. He extinguished the lamps and happened to glance toward the river. A figure was silhouetted against the reflection of the night sky on the rippling water. He knew every inch of the riverbank and was sure he was not looking at a tree or a bush. He whistled a tune and carried the glasses back into the house. He set the tray aside and went over to a locked cabinet where he kept his Bowen. The flat-topped, customized Colt single-action revolver was one of several Bowen models that he collected, in addition to his dueling pistols. He loaded the gun, grabbed a flashlight, and descended from his living room study to the first level, where he kept his racing skull and smaller hydroplane. He slid the door aside on well-oiled rollers and stepped out onto the boat ramp. He let his eyes become accustomed to the darkness and made his way along the foundation of his house, moving across the lawn where Zavala had found him trying out his new dueling pistols. He stopped and stared at the space between two large trees. The figure had disappeared. He decided against a search on his own and crept back into the house and up the stairs, where he called the police and reported a prowler. The police car showed up exactly 8 minutes later. Two officers knocked on his door.
He and the policemen made a thorough search of the area around the house. Austin found a shoe print in the mud near the river, which helped convince the police that he wasn't seeing things. They said they would check back later that night. Austin made sure the doors of the house were locked and the burglar alarm was on. Rather than sleep in his turret bedroom, he stayed fully dressed and stretched out on the living room sofa. He was sure that whoever had been watching his house had left, but he kept his Bowen close by his side.